Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. I am your host, Jonathan. Now, I know this podcast is going up a little later than usual, but I had to go out and see a show. Now, before you get worried, by going out, I mean leaving my bedroom office and going into the living room. If you're not in the know, or if you want to know where all us cool kids are hanging out together while we're cooped up and waiting for the government to seize our sanitizer, go to the Facebook group Viral Music, because kindness is contagious, to check out live performances by amazingly talented artists, including some of your local favorites. I'll put a link in the show notes. Remember, they're putting fluoride in the toilet paper because it's easier to wipe the minds of the panicked masses that way. But I digress. Seriously, check out that Facebook group and remember to tip the artists well, and also their bartenders, whose links I will also put in the show notes, because everyone's lost their gigs, and with our new reality, we need to get more of the stuff that connects us, and the local artists do that through their streaming shows and concerts and posts and home performances, and it helps us all feel human. I'm including a number of other links in the show notes for organizations providing relief to both employees and businesses here in New Orleans, because we're all in this together. The businesses, the employees, the customers who are also employees elsewhere and business owners elsewhere who work gigs and it's all circular and intertwined cannot survive without a good network of support. So scroll down to the end of the show notes and check out all the pertinent links. Get all the help you can at this time. I mean, we're adaptable. We're supposed to be anyway. We're humans. We've been adapting. Things happen. We change to meet those challenges so that we can overcome them or somehow turn them into new victories. I mean, as much as I think the internet was a bad idea, the online community, with the exception of Reddit, is proving me wrong daily by being thoughtful, intelligent, and compassionate. But anyway, now that you've found this little corner of the podcast landscape, sit back, put on some jazz, and listen closely as we continue with part two of The Axeman. I mean, it's not like you have anywhere else to go. Now, up to this point in the story, The Axeman made two reported attacks, one on the Crudy family and another on the Rosettos. As our intrepid Chief Reynolds inspected the Rosetto case, he discovered that, much like the Crudies, they really didn't have any enemies. Even more curious, the attacker didn't take anything, which led the police to believe this wasn't a burglary gone wrong. Another big clue: the meat axe used against the Rosettos had been stolen from a butcher's stall at the market a few weeks earlier. Oddly, a knife stolen from the same market showed up at a grocery store that actually was burgled a short time earlier, roughly 2 miles from the Rosetto place. The more clues the police uncovered, and the more tangential connections Chief Reynolds made, the less sense this case made. The newspapers went wild with speculation. They fell back to the motive that the attack on the Crudies and claimed the assailant was a madman or a drug fiend, and some of the papers even threw in domestic strife. On top of it all, a new motive was brought up, that of vendetta, since both the Crudies and the Rosettos were of Italian descent. However, as was just pointed out, no one could think of any enemies that either family had, certainly none who would take things this far. But sensationalism then, just like now, moved papers. And in 1910, also, unfortunately much like now, people were not above letting stereotypes guide their conclusions. Newspapers even went so far as to call the unknown assailant Jack the Axeman, as a means of claiming New Orleans' own Jack the Ripper, because everyone thought this city was still short on macabre claims to fame, I guess. But anyway, after the attack on the Rosettos, Mr. Rosetto survived, though badly scarred and blind in one eye. Even Mrs. Rosetto, as badly as she was wounded across the neck from the cleaver, the moniker the papers were now giving the attacker, she held on, despite prognostication of the physicians in the hospital. Both survived. And while Mrs. Rosetto defied all assessments and lived until 1940, her husband only lived a mere 2 years following the attack. According to those who knew him, after the attack that night in 1911, Mr. Rosetto was never the same. In late June of 1911, James Reynolds, now Inspector of Police in New Orleans, was in Baltimore when he received a message that the cleaver, again, the moniker that the papers were giving him, was back to his old tricks. Joseph Davi, a 26-year-old Italian grocer, had just closed up his shop on the corner of Arts and Galvez. His 16-year-old wife, expecting child, her name was Mary, she had retired earlier in the evening, leaving Joseph to clean up the store and lock up for the night by himself. He counted the receipts and met his wife in bed, but not before setting a makeshift alarm because the door to the bedroom didn't latch properly. In the middle of the night, Mary woke up after hearing movement and saw a stranger standing in their room. She shook her husband awake, and the stranger asked, "Where's your money?" When neither of the Davies responded, possibly out of fright, the stranger hit Mary with a porcelain mug, and she was knocked unconscious. When she came to, the stranger was gone, and Mary had cuts on her arm and blood dripping from her face. Paralyzed with shock, she stayed still in her bed. The next day, a bartender came knocking on the Davies' grocery store looking to pick up a few items. It was unlike the Davies to not open the store on time. Mary Davi answered that the store wasn't open because her husband was still asleep. The bartender was not just impatient, but he was now worried because he could see Mary's frightened look and the blood was still on her face. Mary then gave a strange response, saying that she tried waking her husband, but couldn't. Now more than a bit concerned, the bartender, as well as a few neighbors, came into the Davies' place to make sure everything was all right, only to find Joseph Davi in a blood-soaked bed. Mrs. Davi had obviously been in shock, and she hadn't quite processed everything that happened up to this point. Mary Davi was taken to the hospital for her wounds and for, quote, being in a delicate state. With Inspector Reynolds out of town, the police were on their own. They noted that the wounds matched the Rosetto case, and, just like in the previous attacks, nothing had been stolen. They eventually questioned Mrs. Davi, and she told the police that the attacker was a white male and the incident took place around 1:30 in the morning. She also asked when she'd be able to see her husband. But the police and medical professionals told her that her husband Joseph had to be hospitalized as well. In reality, Joseph had actually sustained multiple blows to his head to the point where his brain was, quote, pulp. Despite the severity of the injuries, which should have killed him on the spot, Joseph took 30 hours to die. And while Joseph was being given funeral services, the 16-year-old Mary Davi was still in the hospital, unaware that her husband was dead and hoping she'd see him soon. And with that, the Axeman, or the Cleaver, if you prefer, made his first, though still horribly messy and inefficient, kill. Even the governor of Louisiana put out a $500 reward, which is almost $14,000 in today's money, for information leading to the capture and conviction of the killer. Now, before we continue, we need to pause and look at the state of both crime and forensics in New Orleans in 1911. Crime was much lower than it had been in previous years, when murders were so common they couldn't even sell newspapers, and certainly much lower than it is today. However, the police force didn't even total 250 people. And in a city of almost 340,000 at the time, resources were stretched to the limit. But technology had been advancing, and the police in New Orleans were starting to implement systems to more effectively solve cases and catch criminals. New Orleans had been using bertillonnage, a system developed in France for identifying and classifying criminals based on the measurements of their anatomy. This gave way to fingerprinting, and the police were bolstered by a handbook published by an Austrian judge, one Hans Gross, who by name alone was probably no fan of bertillonnage. Gross's book, titled Criminal Investigation, A Handbook for Magistrates, Police Officers, and Lawyers, is still considered the first scientific publication on how to handle witnesses and crime scenes. However, regarding Hans Gross's book, Miriam Davis, author of The Axeman of New Orleans, The True Story, put it best when she wrote, "There is little evidence that anyone in New Orleans read it." New Orleans did still use the bertillonnage system, but they did take photographs of the crime scenes, but other than that, their forensic operations were fairly basic, and many police officers preferred intuition and the third degree to science. Yet, while coaxing a confession out of anyone or railroading a suspect into being convicted as the Cleaver was the preferred method by many officers, Inspector Reynolds wanted the actual killer. So, while the police of New Orleans were left with yet another unsolved attack by a mysterious Cleaver, they were about to get a potential lead. See, Joseph Davi's friend and neighbor, Joe Gallen, told the cops about one Mr. Sam Pizzo. Pizzo was a Sicilian who was a truck farmer. And roughly a week before the murder, Gallen recalled Sam coming into the Davi saloon. Sam and Joe had a rather angry discussion in Italian, which ended with Joe Davi taking $2 out of the register and shoving it at Sam Pizzo just so he'd leave. When Gallen asked about it, Mr. Davi said Sam was pestering him with a sob story about his wife. The tone of the discussion was enough for the police to bring Sam Pizzo in for questioning. The cops weren't even able to get much out of Sam Pizzo, other than he went around telling the same sob story to everyone, trying to get money out of them, just so they would give him money, I guess. Not an unusual thing at the time. in 1911 for anyone to do who was hard on their luck. But the cops couldn't really connect that with the crime, so they let him go. Then Joseph Davi's brother, Peter, told the police that about a year prior, he and Joseph received a mysterious letter that at their old grocery store near Vieux Carré. The letter demanded $200 and stated that if the money was not delivered to a specific address over in Carrollton, that both Joseph and his brother were going to be killed. This was not the first of these letters, and when police asked why neither of the Davi brothers brought this to the cops' attention before, Peter said it was because nothing ever came of these letters, so they just wrote them off. So, between Sam Pizzo being a constant nuisance and the blackmail letters, the police put Sam into a lineup with other suspects and asked Mary Davi if she could identify the killer. She said it might have been Sam Pizzo, but, she added, the killer didn't have a mustache like Sam Pizzo did. Once again, the New Orleans police were back at square one, and Inspector Reynolds needed to reassure the public that they were making progress. Unfortunately, with the state of investigation at the time, the crime scene had not been well preserved, and it was reduced to an attraction for those curiosity seekers with morbid inclinations. I think it's appropriate here to thank you all for listening up to this point. So, with one suspect in prison who was still there at the time of the second and third attacks, that being John Flannery, and a second suspect, Sam Pizzo, who couldn't be charged with anything other than a flimsy blackmail accusation, the police needed to look elsewhere to find the killer. The local newspapers had noted that each of these attacks was made on a grocery store that was owned by people of Italian descent. So people were trying to see whether there were any connections between these crimes and the mafia. The odd thing was, after the murder of Joseph Davi, there weren't any other similar attacks. The cops had to deal with burglaries, breaking up brawls, and homicides that were pretty much committed out of passion, and more often than not, out in the open. The Cleaver seemed to take a vacation. Or he was just arrested for something else and taken off the streets, which is actually what the police thought. And, like many conclusions throughout this story, they were dead wrong. It was not but 6 years later, in late December of 1917, that the Cleaver returned. And that's where we'll pick up next time with part three of The Axeman. If you want to share something about horror or the paranormal or true crime here in New Orleans, join our Facebook page at facebook.com/mothballprophecies, or you can follow me on Twitter at @mothballshow. If you want to email me your stories, suggestions, or comments, drop a line to mothball@crescentcitymedia.com. As always, if you enjoyed this show and want to hear more, please like and share the episodes with your friends. Until next time, sleep tight.